League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It used to be like almost an exclusive club. If you was an F1 fan, it was seen as a bit of a geeky badge of honor in school, or you had a little pocket of people. But it now is fashionable. You know, it's become more readily available and more acceptable to be part of that little group of fans.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week we get behind the numbers to find out what fans think of Formula One today as the 2025 Global F1 Fan Survey breaks cover. We also look at the box office for the opening weekend of F1 the movie and ask what it means for the sport. And we'll hear from the newest team principal on the grid, Graham Loudon, who's bringing Cadillac into Formula One next season. Joining me to talk through all of this, I'm Motorsport's editor-in-chief Ben Hunt. How are you, Ben?
Yeah, very good, James. Very good. Thank you for having me on.
Excellent. And welcome to London to Motorsport F1 writer Emily Selleck. Warm enough for you here in London, Emily?
Very warm, but very honoured to be here. My first appearance on the podcast. Thank you for having me.
And we're looking forward to seeing you up at Silverstone this weekend.
Yes.
It's going to cool off, I think, a little bit for Silverstone, which I personally, for one, am grateful for. But as long as it doesn't rain, that's the main thing. So listen, the results are out for the Global F1 Fan Survey. This happens every 4 years, and we were once again contracted by F1 to conduct it on their behalf. Over 100,000 respondents took part from 186 countries, and the findings make very interesting reading. Fans were self-selecting, so it's important to recognise this isn't a complete picture of all F1 fans worldwide. But what it does show is that F1 is managing the juggling act of attracting new fans while keeping its long-standing fans on board. And there's quite a bit of common ground between the two cohorts, not least that the sporting product of Formula One is at the heart and is very much the most important thing for both of them. Now, another thing they both have in common is they intend to still be following the sport in 5 years from now. 94% of them across the board say that. 61% engage with F1 content every day. That goes up to over 70% among the Gen Z. And female fans now account for 3 in 4 of all new fans to the sport. Ben, this questionnaire took, 10 minutes, I think yes. It was, to complete. But there's an awful lot of information in there. What are some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, I mean, I always think that it's a great barometer to sense where Formula One's progress is. I always think that it's good to look back to where we were 4 years ago. I always dig out the old survey to see what people were saying back then. And then I always go back another 4 years and just seeing what's evolving, what patterns coming through. Because when you go to races and you're at a racetrack, you get a sense of change in the sense of demographics and definitely a younger audience. But it's when the data backs it up and it supports what you feel to be the case. For me, what was quite interesting, the standout figures were the US figures. It's now caught the imagination of the US public. 73% of the American respondents saying that they plan to attend a US-based race in the future. Now, had you have said that to me 10 years ago, I would never have thought that would be the case. I was talking to you, James, earlier about, going to Austin for that first time in 2012. And I took the fan bus and I was listening to conversations about, American fans saying, what do Formula One cars look like? What do they sound like? Now, 12, 13 years on, we're in a scenario that they know everything about Formula One. It's not really about what a car sounds like or looks like. They know all about the personalities. They know the drivers. They know their girlfriends. They know the dog. It's really become part of American culture. And I think that, for me, although I was aware of it, it's now seeing the data that supports what I've been seeing.
And what stood out for you, Emily?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in terms of this conversation, you know, I'm a woman, I'm Gen Z, I'm based in the US. So I think it's been very interesting to read these stats and kind of see myself reflected in parts. I think, as we were saying earlier, obviously this new emerging demographic not only care about everything going on around the sport, but also the racing itself. And I think something we're kind of seeing is that the, you know, older fans, more male fans, tend to have been kind of grandfathered into the sport, you know, kind of watch races perhaps more out of routine, and are less incentivized to be seeking out new content or making those purchases. And I think that's sort of true of male behavior, you know, on the whole. I think there's a reason why, you know, the female demographic 18 to 45 is like the dream audience for someone like F1, because these women, you know, have purchasing power, they're going online, they're building community, creating this fandom. And I think, you know, we're seeing content creators and particularly young women really pushing this sport forward, and that's what I think has been reflected in the survey.
And what came through as well with that kind of cohort is the notion of culture being around this. And that's something I'm really conscious of when I go to Grand Prix. You know, I feel like I'm seeing something far more now than just a sporting event. You know, obviously there's been entertainment layered in for quite some while. That's nothing new. I remember going to see Paul Simon back in the 80s. I mean, in Adelaide, you know, I mean, there's been gigs going on around Grand Prix for a very, very long time. 90s, not 80s. It dates me too much. Sorry, but I think the culture piece is really interesting, and this notion of, like, there's a certain status that comes from being a Formula One fan now, especially for these sort of the newer and younger fans, which I don't think is the case for the older ones. Their reasons for getting into it are different. But maybe you could say a word on this culture piece as you read it.
Yeah, I think people are looking at Formula One now, like newer fans aren't looking at it as just another sports league. So I think F1 doesn't really look like any other sports league. It really only is these 20 drivers, and there's so many storylines around them individually, but you also have the team. So I think it makes F1 so narratively rich. And we're seeing lots of, you know, young women. There's sort of this interesting phenomenon. I'm not sure if this has come across either of your desks, but there is a conversation about people who are big fans of One Direction back 10 years ago, who are kind of leading the charge, you know, in the F1 fandom. And I think that's super interesting, because there's definitely parallels with how people are engaging with F1, you know, the personalities, as Ben was talking about, and those storylines. It's kind of reminiscent of the way people engage with musical acts more than athletes.
So they're looking for something new.
I think so. And F1 is delivering it.
Interesting. We had responses from 186 countries, of which the US had the largest country share. Not something we would have said 5 years ago. Obviously, a lot of what Emily's just been saying is driving that. But again, this whole notion of culture and status, Ben, seems to be at the heart of the appeal in the US, doesn't it?
It's a different way of consuming Formula One as well. I think that's the other element. If you talk back to the traditional European audience, the way that they would consume their F1 content would be the live broadcast, and then the longer written pieces, the analysis that comes from the press conferences afterwards, whereas the younger generation aren't so much interested in that. They're kind of interested in the social Instagram posts and the buzz that goes on around the event. And this is where, you know, Emily's work's great for us on motorsport.com, because she's able to see things through a different lens, and she talks about all the events that are going on behind the scenes, and you bring that side of things to life, which before perhaps didn't exist or we weren't aware of them. And it's tapping into a totally different culture, which is what is reflected within this data. And it's always on, you know, and by that, it means that fans are always searching for the F1 news, which is encouraging for us, you know, as a website, as a journalist writing these stories, is that, you know, there isn't a lull in between races. It feels like there's a race every single weekend. We're not even halfway through the season yet. But you know, we do have breaks, and in that downtime when it's not on the TV, it's important that momentum carries on. Traditionally, that lived in mainstream media, but now we're seeing it's got a home on social media, and it just keeps it ticking over. And I think that's important, because it builds the narrative, it builds the storylines, and it turns these drivers, which is what, you know, F1 ultimately wanted to do. It wanted to turn the drivers from stars into superstars, icons that sort of transcend the sport. Before, we'd always talk about Lewis Hamilton would be one driver, you know, on the grid who could do that. But now you're seeing other drivers sort of come into that sphere, you know, Lando Norris and Charles Leclerc. And now, I'm not saying they're in the same global league as him, but they certainly are appealing to a different type of audience and sort of almost transcend Formula One.
I think that's a really important point. If I go back to when I was commentating on ITV in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, one of the challenges was in those days, the cast of characters, although there were sort of 20 drivers on the grid, the actual cast of characters that people had heard of was pretty small, and the team principals even less so. So we had to work quite hard to create those narratives within the live broadcast, within the TV show. But now all of these 20 drivers have all got a story to tell. And quite a lot of the team principals have got, you know, thanks to Drive Survive and all these other content outlet, they've got their own personalities and their own, you know, their own stories.
That's the key, because people always say in other sport as well, oh, there used to be so many great personalities back in the day, not just in Formula One, but football and other things as well. But the personalities have always been there. It's just how they're developed and how they're presented. And now they're presented in a different way. And that's not through media, it's through their own social media. So they're presenting themselves in a particular way.
Back to your point about the content side of things, it's one of the interesting data points for me, Emily, was 61% of all respondents engage with F1 content on a daily basis. And that goes up to 70% in amongst Gen Z. But that differential comes back to what I was saying about, you know, there's more in common with the longstanding fans with the new fans than people might imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I have friends that don't tune into that many races a year. I mean, being based in New York, it's not always the ideal time zone, but they follow it through highlights on TikTok, through fan edits, through following journalists on Twitter. Like, I think the modern fan really engages with the sport so differently. And kind of to your point, Ben, I think you'd be, you know, if you wanted to TikTok, every single driver has like a strong community of people who are super fans. And I feel like, you know, 10, 20 years ago, whoever was running around the back of the grid definitely didn't have that.
Absolutely not. I mean, back then, I mean, you know, Twitter was the social, you know, that was the key site back then. And it was, you were either popular or you're not. Mm. And I think that the change now is also the platform. So Instagram and TikTok allow different people to engage in different ways, but it's much more mixed and a fairer spread of content. You know, each driver now, you know, actively encourages social media. You know, I think all of them are on it, even Max, who, you know, doesn't like to put too much out there. But and that's a change that we've seen, you know, over the last couple of years.
I think the data point that the teams and the drivers will perhaps appreciate the most, and certainly one I really liked, was that 90% of all of these fans say that they are emotionally invested in the outcome of the race. Now, that might seem like an obvious thing to say, but it's not, because when you watch a sports event, I mean, you know, if you're a football fan, you know, I'm a big Liverpool fan, as everybody knows, I watch a Liverpool game, I'm emotionally invested in the outcome of the game. If I watch, you know, the Manchester Derby or something like that, or Spurs Arsenal, I don't really care what happens, unless maybe perhaps it's going to affect my team's chances in the league. But when you talk about motorsport, as you said before, Emily, it's a different kind of sport. It's a different kind of experience. So it could be quite easy for people to sort of let it wash over them and just in sort of enjoy the intensity of it, but to actually be emotionally invested in the outcome, I think is a real positive for the sport.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it really comes down to like the relationship people have with drivers now, because that was obviously a big finding in the surveys, that people aren't necessarily following teams, they're following individual drivers, which I think is sort of indicative of people finding the sport through Drive to Survive or through social media and developing, I don't want to say parasocial relationships, but, you know, really, as Ben mentioned, they know their dogs, they know their partners, like they know everything about these people. They're invested in their bonds with other drivers on the grid. I think there are so many small storylines throughout a race that have always, you know, always existed, but people are so emotionally invested now, which is great for the sport.
Yeah, it's also that emotional investment as well is crucial, because is it buying into the driver, the driver's personality, or is it the emotional in the thrill of the race, or is it the emotion of the strategy and seeing a team absolutely nail the strategy? You know, there's lots of aspects to it, but the fact that people are so plugged into it is really encouraging. It shows that Formula One's doing something right.
On this podcast, we always like to look at things through a what's next lens as well, though. So what do you think is next? I mean, you've just articulated kind of where we are right now, but these fans who very clearly made their voices heard, they say that they're going to carry on watching races, for example, live on TV, which is very encouraging for the TV companies. They're obviously going to carry on following the drivers and looking at the socials. They're obviously going to carry on following the sport. 94% of them intend to still be following in 4 years from 5 years from now. That must be the most golden stat, I think, for Formula One out of the whole thing, because they can really bank on that interest. And I guess the longevity of the circuit contracts, promoter contracts, broadcast contracts, you know, speak to that kind of long-term demand and long-term health. But what's the next turn of the wheel here?
It's a good question. I think possibly like the biggest challenge the sport has is that we only have these 20 drivers. And in terms of the media they do and the social media, they're kind of already at their max. And so obviously so much of the survey kind of spoke about people's relationship with these drivers and the content they produce. But I don't know there's much more they can be doing. So in terms of growth in that space, I'm not entirely sure what it's going to look like, but I'm curious to see sort of how sponsors and other stakeholders in the sport, you know, kind of change how they interact with teams and with drivers, because it was interesting to see that lots of even young fans think really positively about sponsors and are obviously more likely to purchase, which is great to hear for them. But yeah, I'm kind of curious to see. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, no, branding's a really interesting point. And I know that we talk about the Formula One film, and there's a lot of branding in that Formula One film, but it's how fans engage with those brands through association with the sport. And I think that is an interesting element. To do the what's next, if we're looking at trends, 10%, 18%, 25% in terms of female respondees over 2017, 2021 and 25, that's obviously an upward trend. And that is something that I would love to see continue. And if I go back to what I was saying earlier on about seeing it with your own eyes, I remember, you know, pre-COVID, I always use this as an example. I don't know why, but Hungarian Grand Prix always used to be an event that people would turn up to, mainly from Finland, wearing old Williams tops.
So true.
You know,
so
true. And they would all be sort of sun-drenched and red and everything. But they would always be like old team gear. And I was, you know, it was endearing for whatever reason. But then post-COVID, post-Drive to Survive, I remember going to that race and there were young people, but not only young people, there were women. And I was like, wow, you know, what a difference. It's no longer the old people, it's the young people. And they were all dressed in brand new team gear. You know, like the football shirt thing with, you know, they bring out a new kit and everyone has to buy the new kit. It's such a change, you know, and it goes back to that Bernie Eccleston point about young people don't buy Rolexes. We're not in the sport for them. But he missed the point.
He was missing the point.
Absolutely. And these young generation with disposable income, the rise of the female fan, they're willing to buy team gear. And now every time you go to a race, what you see in all the grandstands, it's all papaya or Red Bull gear or whatever it is. It's quite a turnaround.
And so if you go to Selfridges now, they've got a pop-up store, which was last week around the time of the F1 movie launch here in London. And then obviously in the run-up to the British Grand Prix this week at Silverstone. And the team there, which is, they're absolutely razor sharp. They do all this amazing sort of Snoopy collab merchandise around the Vegas Grand Prix and around Miami. I don't know if you've seen it. It's fantastic. Anyway, the people have done that. They put this pop-up store at Selfridges. So they've got all the contemporary gear, but they've also got a archive stuff. They've got, you know, historic stuff. They've got team shirts from Benetton from the 90s. And I was thinking I might go up in the loft and dig out my old Brabham shirts from the early 90s. I started in Formula One working for a team. It was a Brabham team. I've got the old Hissing Sid shirts.
So it makes some good money these days on that.
Exactly, yeah.
But it's like the retro football shirts, isn't it? But the point is, it's now coming in.
Yeah.
So now the new thing, I'm sure what we'll start to see more and more of is people actually, you know, having demand for retro gear as well as modern.
But look at us also talking about brands that are old brands in Formula One, but current brands in Formula One. We're doing what the survey tells us. We wouldn't have been probably having this conversation a few years ago about the strength of brands and merchandise and kit within Formula One. It's just a very different, evolving picture. And as I say, we see it on a day-to-day basis when we go to the races, but this proves it in the data.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Selfridges pop-up as well kind of speaks to the fact that F1 is listening to female fans now, because I think around the time Drive Survive started, there was this big conversation about how all the merchandise was for men.
Yeah, that's
it was
right.
All
yeah.
Ugly polo shirts that women didn't want to wear. And women were saying, we will spend money. We will throw our money at you. Give us a product that we want to buy. And I think they're properly listening now.
So the breakdown of how fans actually come into Formula One is interesting. And again, the caveat here is this is not a snapshot of all Formula One fans worldwide. Only people who wanted to complete this survey, and obviously one of the beauties of doing this on our platform is that we've got quite a big avid fan base, as well as casual fans, as well as new fans. So that's why you get a real 360 picture. Nevertheless, 39% of them came through friends and family getting him into the sport. Social media is only 12%, and drivers another 12. I guess there's an overlap there. And then Drive to Survive is 10%. Now, I think in terms of the pure new fans, the data point there will obviously be higher for Drive to Survive. But nevertheless, that's not the only gateway. And I've always thought that the friends and family thing is powerful. But I've got friends in America who were like, you know, absolutely sort of on their own in their F1 fandom. They had no one to talk to about it. And now they can't stop themselves from talking about it.
Well, we're seeing that thing. And I think it used to be like almost like an exclusive club. If you was an F1 fan, it was seen as maybe a bit of a geeky badge of honour in school, or you had a little pocket of people. But it now is fashionable. And when you see people walking around in F1 merchandise in the shops and it's become popular, it's become, acceptable is not the right word, but it's become more mainstream popular. Popular is the word. And that's great to see. You know, it's become more readily available and more acceptable to be part of, you know, that little group of fans.
I mean, Abercrombie, the store, sells McLaren merchandise. And at first, I assumed everyone was walking around a huge McLaren fan. So I'd be at a bar and I'd got to him and be like, oh, you're a Lando fan. And I remember the one time this guy was like, who's that? Who's Lando? He just had bought this shirt because he thought it looked cool. Wow. I mean, it's such a change from even a few years ago.
Yeah. You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Data also shows that F1 Academy is starting to cut through. And bear in mind that a lot of the field work for this study was done before F1 Academy launched their Hello Sunshine reality show on Netflix. 23% of all F1 fans follow F1 Academy. And amongst women, that rises to 42%. And for them, it's actually the second most watched race series after F1. I mean, ahead of MotoGP, ahead of IndyCar and all the rest. Emily, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that speaks more broadly to this idea, like this long-held idea that people don't want to watch women's sports. And I think there are a range of factors that have proved, no, there's just been no easy way to watch sports. Like, it hasn't been promoted. It hasn't been, like, cool, for lack of a better word, for a long time. And I think F1 Academy is this, you know, slick product. Susie Wolf is doing a great job. They're marketing it really well. And people are showing up. And I think that's true across the board. I mean, in the US, the WNBA has had this, you know, massive explosion, and it's taken about 20 years for them to get there. So it is really encouraging that after a couple of seasons, they're really finding like a fandom around F1 Academy.
The difference, of course, is that whereas the WNBA, they're never going to play against the men. The whole point of motorsport at the top end, or anywhere actually, apart from F1 Academy, which is a development series, is that men and women can race together in equal machinery. It's one of the beauties of our sport. Do you think people get it that F1 Academy is a means to an end?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a piece about the Hello Sunshine show recently, and I think the one sort of downfall was they didn't really explain F1 Academy's place sort of in the ladder. Because if you were to hear F1 Academy, you would assume that's like the step before F1 if you knew nothing about the sport. And I do think kind of the messaging and the education around that is missing a little bit. But the overall point of F1 Academy is to promote this series to a four-year-old girl who will then go pursue karting and maybe be a world champion in 15 years' time. So I think, you know, from that lens, they're succeeding, but I do think there's some education that can be done a little bit better around it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, I go back to W Series. I remember when that started, I was a big fan of that championship. I thought it offered such a great potential. And I was quite upset when it fizzled out. But then I was delighted when F1 Academy started up and it filled the void. And I think the good thing is that people have, they see F1 Academy and they identify with the cars, the teams, and they can see the progress and the association with Formula One. And I think that's the natural aspect. And that's what's kind of missing with Formula 3 and Formula 2 at the moment, is that there's no real obvious synergy. The Red Bull cars look very similar, and McLaren ones maybe, but there's not really too much similarity between the different championships. But in F1 Academy, there is. And I think that's what needs to happen.
Good stuff. Well, it's timely that the survey results come out this week, because F1, the movie, is out there now, making its pitch to old and new fans and to people it hopes to turn into fans. The box office numbers for the movie, according to Variety, are pretty positive. $144 million worldwide for the first weekend. That's three-day numbers. I'm told that's Brad Pitt's best ever opening weekend for any of his movies. So a strong start means it's likely to overtake Napoleon as Apple's highest grossing movie, probably in the next week or so, and it's only just come out. What comments have you heard now from the wider fan base, now that it's not just sort of journalists and drivers and team principals who've been allowed to watch it?
I should point out here, Emily and I went to see it in Montreal as a special screening, and we was all such a cynical bunch sitting there. We'd come straight from the press day, and we sat as a group, and we kind of picked at it a little bit. But Emily's had the luxury of seeing it a second time now.
I have.
It was in the premiere.
Yeah, saw it again in New York. It's a good film, you know. It's a great film. I've had lots of friends who are not big F1 fans go see it. It's a good time. People are comparing it to Top Gun Maverick. I think that was the whole point. It's obviously doing well at the box office. I mean, it's important to note that Apple has never promoted a movie before. This is kind of the first film they've actually pushed, so I'd be surprised if it doesn't overtake Napoleon very, very shortly. But yeah, it's a good thing for the sport if it does well. So I think, you know, there are a few things that we nitpicked, I think, fairly. But, you know, overall, I'm happy it's doing well.
Yeah, and I think my initial reaction, I know my colleague Mark Membrines was pretty upset with it, but my initial reaction was it was what was required to attract a new fan base. And of course, you roll with the Hollywood element, the scripts and some of the dialogue is a bit cheesy, but you accept that because the broader message is that it's trying to take Formula One to a new audience that hadn't engaged with it before. And, you know, we talk about seeing trends in this survey data. Let's see what happens 4 years down the line, because will the success of that Formula One film be reflected in those numbers? You know, that's where I'm interested to see what happens. But I enjoyed the movie. I think the action shots were great. It will appeal. It will do well. And it is, as I said, trying to engage a new market. It's not for me. It's for other people.
Well, Emily, you wrote a piece after the first time you saw it, which got a lot of attention, which was all about the female perspective on the movie. Two principal characters there, one being the chief engineer, the technical director, who's a woman, and the kind of the main female part in it, and then also a mechanic who does the wheel change and is kind of made to feel bad early on because she makes a mistake, but obviously redeems herself later on. But she doesn't like it when Brad Pitt tries to sort of kind of create a sort of a redemption moment for her, if you like, in front of everybody else. She calls him out for it. So what kind of reaction did you get to that piece, first of all?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of positive reaction, to be honest. People sort of saying, I've not heard anyone else speak about this. And obviously at that time, the movie hadn't been released, you know, widely at that point. You know, I stand by it. I think that the positioning of the women in the film is definitely a bit problematic. I mean, we sort of asked Jerry and Joe broadly about our critiques of the film, and they were trying to hammer home this message that it's all about the story and being entertaining. And, you know, I'll put my hands up and say, you know, the unrealistic racing scenes actually do serve the story. Obviously, you know, Brad going from last to first, not realistic, but it makes sense. I think him having to, I don't know, hook up with the female technical director doesn't actually serve the story. So I don't know that really holds up for me.
No, there was the other element as well, wasn't there? The other driver's mum, quite clearly, you know, fancies Brad Pitt. I thought that was an unnecessary element.
Yeah.
And then there was the element with the woman in the club that says to the other driver, Joshua Pierce, do you know Carlos Sainz? You know, and it was a bit toe-curling. I think is for me.
I think especially people are kind of bringing up the fact that Lewis Hamilton was so heavily involved in the film and, you know, ostensibly he cares very deeply about women in motorsport. What kind of role did he have, if any, in being able to sort of shape the script and, you know, these sorts of storylines? Because it really did feel, as you say, that every time a woman spoke, it was sort of about a man.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you there, because I actually thought the Kerry Condon part of the female technical director, I watched it and I thought she pulled that off magnificently. She's paid credit to Ruth Buscombe and Bernie Collins, both of whom, as everybody knows, were very prominent female race strategists for a number of years, both super aggressive, super smart, super clever, sitting on the pit wall, making the decisive calls. And they kind of obviously gave her an aesthetic, a way to portray herself, a way to think about it. And I think she pulls it off really, really well. Everything from like the way she kind of wears her shirt and how her past is around, how she kind of wears the headphones in the debrief, how she conducts herself. It's completely believable. And I did find it quite disappointing that she ends up, you know, having a fling with Brad Pitt, because it's so sort of predictable in that sense. Even though she starts it just as much as he does, that doesn't really make any difference. It's sort of, does it really have to evolve like that? But credit to her is what I want to say, because I think she totally pulls it off.
She does. And the length that she went to fulfill that role, she was talking to Bernie Collins, and I watched this on the Sky broadcast at the weekend, and she said, on your notepad, what do you have written down so that I replicate that for the shots? You know, so it'll say whatever tire strategy or whatever. So she was trying to make it as authentic as possible. The other flip side is that, you know, and this is to take Emily's point about being sort of the negative, is that she had been responsible for designing this car, which was no good. And then all of a sudden, Brad Pitt turns up and tells her what to do. And then all of a sudden, the car's good again. And that, I thought, again, a little bit unnecessary. She should have been able. Yes. She should have been able to do that herself. It didn't need that Brad Pitt element. But, I mean, we're nitpicking, and this is where we're at. I think ultimately it was a great film. People should go and see it and make up their own minds.
Well, it seems that plenty of people have already. One new team next season that's obviously missed out on being in the film because they haven't started in F1 yet, but they will be hoping to attract new fans, is Cadillac. And for an exclusive interview, Ben went up to Cadillac's factory at Silverstone to talk to team principal Graham Loudon. You can catch the full interview on our YouTube channel, but here's a taster of it.
Yeah, you know, it helps that a lot of the key people, kind of, you know, myself included, have been involved in Formula One for quite some time. So a lot of it is actually personal trust. But also, you don't have to look far. If you look at the kind of the three pillars that support this project, you've got this team of people that we're pulling together. But we've got General Motors, you know, one of the biggest automotive manufacturers in the world. You know, their history of innovation and also their involvement in motorsport as well, and TWG Group as well, you know, who bring, you know, really unbelievable understanding of sport and a great vision in sport, not just in motorsport but in other sports as well, you know, like basketball and baseball, and also their business acumen as well. So again, you know, the ingredients for something special are there.
Also, it's slightly different from most Formula One teams which are based in the UK. We're obviously here at Silverstone, you've shown us around the factory, but the headquarters is going to be in the US, and you're going to be reliant upon US staff building the majority of the car.
Yeah, so, you know, we're building the global headquarters for Cadillac Formula One team in Fishers, which is on the outskirts of Indianapolis. GM have technical facilities as well in Charlotte in North Carolina, and also Warren, Michigan. And then, you know, we're building our own power unit facilities in the US as well. So, yeah, we're dealing with a lot of these sites. But I think a cool thing is, you know, our global headquarters is in Indianapolis, so it's the home of IndyCar. We've got our presence in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is the home of NASCAR. And then here we are in our Silverstone operation, which is the home of Formula One. So there's a motor racing DNA that runs throughout everything to do with the team.
And what will Cadillac bring to Formula One, do you think?
Well, first of all, an unbelievable brand. You know, it's the strength of the brand is huge. You look at the history of it; its history of innovation, which continues now with the product line that they have now, and certainly historically, you know, they have over 120 years of history of innovation. But also, you know, they're not new to racing as well. You know, it's one of the things that really attracted me when I knew that General Motors were involved, and specifically Cadillac. Is you know, they have deep rooted interest in racing, and they're highly competitive, and they display, you know, all of the attributes that you want in a OEM partner as well. And of course, they're bringing scale and stability as well. They're an enormous company, and there's a lot we can learn from them.
And of course, the potential for a power unit is another aspect.
Yeah, it's not a small task to venture into making a Formula One power unit, and the commitment from General Motors and from Cadillac to go forward with the PU project. Now, again, these projects take some time to come through, but you know, we're realistic about what the team can achieve. You know, we'll never overpromise. But I think it is important to have ambition, and you know, we do want to be competitive, and to do that, having control over every facet of the car is a key thing.
We're around 250 days away from the first race in Australia. Are you on track with everything at this moment in time?
Yes, thankfully. And there's a lot, of parallel tracks, and it's always more difficult when you're doing it for the first time. But luckily, we've got, you know, some people who have done that before. And so, yes, you know, we're on track, and you know, genuinely looking forward to it.
Awesome. My final question is about driver lineup. There's lots of speculation. You're not going to confirm your driver lineup to me now, but no. Could you tell me what sort of blend that you're looking for? Is it experience, youthful? Which sort of route do you think you'll be going down?
You know, we talk about this a lot. Within the team, we're out of sync at the minute with the other teams in terms of competitive market for drivers, which is kind of helpful in some ways because we can have a bit more time. And I think we need that time as well, because what we're going to ask these drivers to do is maybe a little bit different from an established team. So, you know, we're looking for this kind of really quite unique mix of you know, clearly they have to be competitive. And they've got to be quick, but they also have to understand how a new team comes together, help gel a team together as well. I think the experience is important. So yeah, it's quite a clever mix of kind of attributes that we need. But you know, we're in luck. There's more than two or three drivers out there who would fit the bill.
So it would be experience rather than youthful, because you're implying there that you do need to have that.
Yeah,
that,
but you know, there are some experienced youthful drivers as well. So it is that mix, and we genuinely, you know, we look at every driver on all the merits that they can bring. You know, we've said a number of times before, we'll select drivers on merit. That's not just single lap time. It's going to be a mix of all sorts of things. You know, obviously outright pace is important. So is race pace. So is how they work with engineers, how they develop car. You know, there's just such a mix of things. And you're right. We can't announce the drivers just yet, but I'm sure when the time's right, we'll let you know.
Hopefully soon.
Ben, what's the Silverstone setup like?
It's I feel sorry for them because, you know, as Graham mentioned when we did our interview, it took 700 plus days for that application process to be rubber stamped. When they got it, it was roughly 12 months before the start of the season. And then they're scrambling. They need factories. They need space. They need to find out where they're going to be based. Everything, as he says in the interview, is going to be eventually based out of the US. But they do have a hub in the UK. At Silverstone, six factories, James. Six giant warehouses spread all over the place, almost looking identical. What was really interesting was being there when the equipment was being delivered, all wrapped in cellophane, and you've got people trying to design car parts, build car parts, you know, build a wind tunnel model, recruiting various different positions. It feels like there's a lot going on all under six different roofs. So there's a lot of moving parts. I think that it is an ambitious project. I think that they have definitely got their work cut out. Ultimately, in a, you know, maybe when this fan survey comes out in 4 years' time, there'll be a different picture. But Cadillac are going to initially struggle. There's no doubt about that, despite the might of GM. Just because purely because it's in so many different countries and factories. But ultimately, there's a lot of positivity behind it, which is really good. Graham Loudon's been there, done it. Very smart guy, pulling it all together. You know, I wish them well.
Yeah, there's a lot of people on the technical side who've been in Formula One before. They know what it takes, et cetera, et cetera. But this idea of operating things out of the US, we've heard these ideas before. I think the first people to float it was US F1. Do you remember when they kind of broadened out the franchise in the Max Mosley era of the FIA, and they wanted to dilute the power of the manufacturers? So actually Graham Loudon with Manor Marussia, as they were called, at Caterham, and one of the teams that was trying to come in at that time, US F1, that never really happened, but they were trying to operate out of the US. And Haas have got a presence in the US, but they run the cars out of Banbury. So we've heard these ideas before, but why do you think Cadillac have decided it's the right move for them?
Because I think it's something different. It's something American that they can get behind.
Is it the made in America?
I think there's a lot of that there, yes. And I think that if you flip it the other way around, yes, we have Motorsport Valley where everyone's competing for work and there's a lot of talent there, but then you've got a country for, you know, 360-odd million people where there is a lot of engineering going on already. That's an untapped market for Formula One. We talk about untapped market for fans. All of a sudden, now we've got an untapped workforce. You know, we could, you know, there's a lot of people over there, skilled people over there, who could find work in Formula One working for the Cadillac F1 team once that base is all built in Fishers, you know, not far from Indianapolis. So a whole massive potential area for them. I think that it would be a, you know, Haas get a little bit prickly with this when you say that, you know, a whole new F1, American F1 team. They're like, hang on a minute, we're an American-owned F1 team, but this will be a proper American F1 team in the sense that it's based there. The Silverstone office will be condensed down from, I think, 6 buildings to 3, and it will be like a technical hub, which makes sense, you know, for infrastructure and certainly the European races. If there's quick pieces to turn around, there's going to be a lot of training. I think that's probably going to be the biggest thing over the next couple of years, getting everyone in America up to speed. Fascinating project. Let's see where it ends up.
And are you convinced that all the sort of politics, that sort of the negative politics that sat around it in the build-up to this, which delayed them getting their clearance, as you said, you know, which was particularly around Andretti and all that sort of thing. I mean, he's not part of this, yeah, to be absolutely clear. Dan Taris is obviously an important part of it. He was working with Andretti, but they've gone forward without Andretti, basically. Is that all in the rearview mirrors,
I think so.
Now? I mean, are all the team principals going to be comfortable with... Yeah. With this, and are they going to be?
I think so at the moment. In the same way that they know they're not going to be a threat, I think that the moment that they realise it's a threat, they've sort of changed their mind. But for the time being, they're going to be struggling to keep up. You know, for me, James, we were talking about it earlier on. It felt like they've got so much to do between now and the tests in, you know, Barcelona, the winter tests, and then obviously the Bahrain, and then the season opener and Australia. It feels like they've got so much to do. And I was saying it felt like shades of Williams a few years ago when they were turning up at testing and no car was ready. I hope we're not going to see that scenario because there's, you know, so much resting on this. But it feels like they've got so much to do.
Yeah. I mean, kind of to tie it back to the survey, I think we saw the stat that people who have a home race, I think it was like Italy and Netherlands, have a stronger connection to F1. We have all these American fans who would love to support like a proper American team. And I think that's where Haas kind of fell short a bit. They never properly embraced being an American team. And that's what I would love to see, because I think there's lots of people that would be willing to really jump behind them.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, Haas came in because they wanted to sell machine tools, yeah, all around the world. And using,
I couldn't believe that,
the platform to, yeah, sort of, you know, host basically machine tool buyers in China and all the rest of it, which is great, and it's a really good business strategy, and I'm sure it succeeded really nicely for them. But
I just couldn't believe that was
leaving much on the table, yeah, that's undone. They missed out this whole opportunity.
I want to see the eagle on the car. I want to see red, white, and blue, and it turned up in Barcelona grey, and I was like, hang on, this must be just some sort of test livery. And I remember having a discussion. They're like, no, this is it. We just want to be seen as the established Formula One team. I'm like, wow, felt like a missed opportunity, which hopefully Cadillac will get right. And, you know, Graham's right. He said this is an important moment because teams do come and go, but there's only, and then obviously some stay around for a long time, but they only launch once, and it's important to get that launch right.
You can only introduce yourself to people once. It's very, very true. And of course, when Haas did do that, thanks to Ruth Buscombe and her very aggressive strategies, they got a lot of big points very early on. I remember her leaving, I think it was Grosjean, out for ages, hoping for a safety car, and she got one and got a huge point, like fifth or sixth or something in one of the early races. Really, really good stuff. So, as we said earlier on, fans follow drivers. Emily, what's your hunch? Any news on which way you think we're going to, Cadillac are going to go on drivers?
Yeah, but we were just talking about this. Obviously, Ben, you know, spoke to the team. It's kind of looking like Bottas and Perez are properly up there. I mean, what did Ladon have to say about the rookies?
Yeah, I think that the Graham's very much of the mindset. I mean, you know, you're coming into a team, they are playing catch up. They need someone that can provide a benchmark and feedback. And I think for me, that someone is Valtteri Bottas. I think that he's stayed sharp even when he's out of Formula One. He's still involved in the simulator work, which is a different prospect to Perez, who's left Formula One, left Red Bull, and has disappeared. You know, okay, there's the occasional social media post, but he's not staying, you know, sharp, relevant in the same way that the Bottas is, who's still travelling to races. He's there to be called upon, still very much involved in the Mercedes programme. For me, he would be a good fit. I was talking about this earlier on in the sense that, you know, he does tend to rely on these 1+1 year contracts. Every year it comes up and he's renewed. Cadillac do have a possibility of offering him some, you know, longevity in Formula One, maybe a two or three year deal. You know, he's being mooted as a potential driver for Alpine. I don't think that would be the right move. I think if I was Valtteri Bottas, I would like to think the Cadillac one would be good. The thing is, for the second seat, I don't really know who you put in there. Do you put someone young, like the F1 film, or do you or do you stick to two other drivers? For me, I wouldn't personally pick Perez. I think, as I say, he's come out of Formula One and it will take him a little bit of time to get back up to speed. But who knows?
I mean, I'm curious to see how Jack Crawford kind of shapes up in the rest of the F2 season. I mean, yeah. I think he's quick. I'm not sure if he's F1 ready, but he's kind of the next American in line that Cadillac could theoretically pick up as a reserve next year.
Yeah, I mean, there was Alex Dunn at the weekend. I mean, look at that performance. You know, he come from, you know, pretty much nowhere, popped in that McLaren car and impressed everyone, and now everyone's saying he needs to be on the grid next year. There's only so many space.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I think they definitely need a team builder in there, and I think one of the things Bottas has got in his favour is that he is current, and he also knows what a winning team looks like. I think the fundamentally important thing, though, for me, if I was in Loudon's shoes, I would really want someone who understood the Ferrari DNA, because they are going to be very reliant on that Ferrari back end of the car. And if you're coming from a sort of, as Perez would be, first of all, he's been out of it for a year and he's not really a current. He's not there. Secondly, his experience is all with a Honda engine in there, or a Honda Red Bull engine in the back. He hasn't got any Ferrari experience. I think Bottas's combination of knowing the Ferrari DNA of the back end of the car, but also knowing Mercedes and knowing how that all works, for me, looks good. The underlying numbers when he was at Sauber showed that he was actually performing reasonably well, even though people would look at it now and think, well, look at Hülkenberg. He's got in that car and he's doing a much better job. So I think that needs to, I think Cadillac really need to understand that dynamic. But I think of the two, Bottas would be the one I'd go for, mainly because of that Ferrari experience.
Joe could be a fit then, because obviously he's worked with Loudon. You know, Graham's been his manager and obviously he's tied into the Ferrari program. So,
but less of a team builder experience, I would
very
say.
True.
I think he felt like a rookie even in his second year. And then for the second car, you know, with an American, you know, I hear what you're saying about Crawford. It would be good. It's always a bit the same when with the Japanese drivers in the past. It's good to have a Japanese driver in the car if they're competitive.
Exactly.
But it's going to be counterproductive if they're not. And I think it probably would be the same.
What? Americans like a winner.
Yeah, they didn't like Logan Sargeant for that reason.
Yeah, exactly. They certainly do. All right. Well, I'm sure it'll all become clear. It felt to me from the interview as though the sort of lead driver is going to get announced either just this side of the summer break or just after the summer break.
Yeah, I think something soon.
There will be some movement anyway in the driver market at that time, we're expecting. And then maybe the second driver, they can bide their time a little bit towards the end of the season. So we will see, but that'll do us for now. My thanks to Ben and to Emily. You can read them on Motorsport, and you can hear Ben's full interview with Graham Loudon of Cadillac on Autosport's YouTube channel. Check out all the latest F1 news and insights from this weekend's British Grand Prix on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. And if you want to find out more about that global F1 fan survey and download your own copy if you want, it's pretty comprehensive. Used to be good holiday reading on the beach. The link is in the episode description notes. Do join our Fantasy League community. Check out motorsport.com for details or the episode description notes. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllenandF1 on X. My thanks to producer Dre, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow, leave us a review, tell all your F1 mad friends about us and the movie and the survey, and we'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel, wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.